We'll call the Pension Commission back to order. And we have Pensions 101. So, oops, we lost a few House members. There's some talking going on back there, too. But anyway, we are going to let Susan Lucheski and Rachel Barth start off first, please, and give us your overview. You do have a handout also, members. Feel free to go back and get more pizza.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So Susan and I are going to provide a very brief overview of the Pension Commission and just some basic aspects of the public pension plans. Okay.
Or I can.
Yep. So the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, which is also referred to as the LCPR, the Pension Commission, or just the Commission, consists of 14 legislators, 7 representatives, and 7 senators. Our governing statute, which is 3.85, allows the majority party from each body to select a maximum of 5 members. So the typical makeup is 5 members from the majority and 2 members from the minority from each body. So the Commission's executive committee is the chair, the vice chair, and the secretary. And as Representative O'Driscoll mentioned, the chair switches between the House and Senate every 2 years. And the Commission was established to have bipartisan, bicameral review of pension and retirement issues, really focusing on legislation dealing with the state's public pension plans. So 3 full-time nonpartisan employees staff the commission, and we introduced ourselves earlier, but we have the executive director, Susan Lucheski, the deputy director, which is me, Rachel Barth. Susan and I are actually both attorneys, so that's kind of the role we play. And then our commission assistant, Lisa Dieslin. And staff are really here to assist the commission on meeting preparation and the commission and the legislature as a whole with drafting legislation and background policy and legal analysis of bills and topics. The commission contracts with Deloitte Consulting to provide actuarial services and assistance. And Deloitte will actually be presenting after we're done later in the meeting, so you'll get a chance to meet them as well. Our offices, the commission offices, are located in room 55 of the state office building. And we also maintain a website with the link up there that provides meeting and legislation updates, as well as background documents on pension issues and reports that are written and conducted by Deloitte and the pension plan's actuaries. So just kind of an overview of like the commission agenda throughout the session. So as of right now, it seems that the commission will meet weekly each Tuesday evening to consider proposed legislation and discuss current pension issues. Meeting agendas are typically organized to consider similar bills as a group each week. Some of the types of bills that the commission has traditionally dealt with and will likely appear this session are legislators' proposals for benefit or other changes, pension plan administrative or technical changes, pension plan funding proposals, legislation for volunteer firefighter relief associations, and small group or individual bills, which are called special legislation. The commission may also consider the plan's actuarial assumptions, which can be amended by motion rather than statute, except for the investment return assumption, which must be amended statutorily.
So I'll talk just a few moments here on the public pension plan. So one of the primary functions of the Pension Commission is to provide oversight of the public pension plans in the state of Minnesota. In your packet is a chart that is new to the commission. We've been working on this over the course of the summer and have now come up with this sort of what we're calling pension plan basics. It lists some demographic information about the big three, which is MSRS General, Parageneral, and the Teachers Retirement Association, as well as St. Paul Teachers, which is the remaining first-class city association. So those are we'll have those in the packets for every meeting in case you want to refer to any of this data. As mentioned on the slide, MSRS administers 5 different pension plans. PARA has 4 pension plans. I mentioned TRA earlier in St. Paul. And then there's about 700 volunteer firefighter relief associations around the state. In addition, there are defined contribution plans in the state of Minnesota that are available for state employees. The MSRS unclassified plan is a relatively smaller plan. It's for legislators, legislative staff, state government management, and agency employees. The public employees defined contribution plan, another DC plan that's a relatively small plan, and then a much larger DC plan called the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan. Interestingly, it has 85,000 individual accounts, so individual participants in that plan, and it has about $6 billion in assets. So there is a little bit of experience here in the state of Minnesota with defined contribution plans for public employees.
Representative Murphy.
Ms. Vichesky, could you say what the assets were again?
For the, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. Yes, $6.1 billion in the deferred compensation plan.
$6.1 billion.
Yes. Yes.
Ms. Lechesky.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just a little bit on governance. Each system has a governing board and an executive director. The board members and the executive director for each of the plans are all fiduciaries, so they are governed by our state fiduciary laws, which are very much like ERISA, if any of you are familiar with that. So it's a high standard. They are required to administer the plans prudently and for the benefit of the participants or for the benefit of the members and their beneficiaries. Each system also has its own actuary. So separate from Deloitte, which is the commission's actuary, each of the plans has an actuary and does an annual actuarial evaluation. Each plan is governed by Minnesota statutes. So there's a section or a chapter of the statutes that applies to each of the plans. And these statutes are the plan documents. So in the private sector, the plan documents are able to be amended by the board of directors. In this scenario, the plan documents are the statutes, and they can only be amended by the legislature, by the pension commission, then approving that legislation and moving it through the process. The assets, as we are well aware from the earlier presentation, are invested by the State Board of Investment. Mention of the sources of funding for the pension plans. All of the plans have both employee and employer contributions going into them. The employee contributions are mandatory. The very first day of employment, contributions start being deducted from payroll, and so each employee is participating right away in the plan. There are also supplemental employer contributions to both teachers and St. Paul. Those are also a percentage of pay, so very, very much like and really additional to the employer contributions. And then there are also additional contributions that are just sort of lump sum amounts being made by the state into PARA and TRA to assist those funds with liabilities that they took on when plans, smaller plans, were merged into them. The stakeholders, these I would view as all of the people who have an interest in the plan and would come to these meetings and express opinions about changes being made. Those are, of course, the payors, the employers. So those are state agencies, school districts, cities, counties, all the employees, former employees. So these are people who have a benefit in the plan but are not yet ready to take that benefit because they haven't reached retirement age. Retirees, people right now receiving benefits, the unions, I mention that not because they have any right to bargain over pensions, but that they do obviously have a sort of behind-the-scenes interest in what happens here because they do have, they do bargain over compensation, but not pension benefits. And then finally, the taxpayers, who of course are funding what the employers are ultimately then contributing to the plans. We have at the end of our presentation here a couple of slides that are from our website, and I just wanted to note a couple of places you might want to look if you have any questions. There's a drop-down under the heading Minnesota Pension Plan Information. It's kind of right in the center of the screen. if you do that drop-down, you'll find their links to each of the public pension plans, as well as links to their actuarial valuation reports and experience studies. And those are just filled with really important information about each of the plans, their funding status, all the information you really could want to learn about those issues would be available there. And then further down the screen, on the right side of the screen, there's some really helpful information for the commission in that as we start building our omnibus pension bill, you can always click on that and find its most recent iteration. And then right under that will be all of the pending pension bills that have been introduced in the legislature that deal with pensions or retirement issues. And those two, you can click into those and take a look at the pension bills that are have been introduced. That's the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions, or we can turn it over to Deloitte.
Well, thank you, Ms. Lucheski. That's very, very useful, especially about the website. I should actually use that more. And also, members, I do want to go back to that principles of the pension policy that will be in your folder every week. This is really important. We do go back to this quite a bit as a reference point. And I just want to make that known. With that, we have Deloitte here. And thank you very much to Judy Stromback, who is the Chief Pension Actuary for Deloitte Human Capital, national practice. She's got 34 years of experience as a actuarial consultant. And also, Mr. Michael DeLeon is a specialist leader in Deloitte Consulting's human capital practice and has over 19 years of experience in consulting with the defined benefit pensions plans and post-retirement medical plans, including extensive experience with public sector retirement systems. There you go. So, and that is, there's a bio, members, in your handout. With that, welcome. Thank you for your time doing this, too. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. We have put together some mostly educational information. Some of this is very, very basic, but we felt it was an important first meeting, perhaps, to just get everyone on the same page about some of the issues that you may be dealing with in this coming session. So what we're planning to talk about today is just quickly what our role is serving the commission, and then give you kind of a basic 101 on the actuarial valuation process, which I promise you is probably as boring as it sounds, but I'll try to get through that part quickly so that we can get to the actual summary of the status of the current Minnesota systems, which I think you will find more interesting. And then I'm going to turn it over to Michael, and he's going to give you some information about the public sector pension landscape. As Senator Rosen mentioned, I have been with Deloitte my whole career, and I'm the National Chief Pension Actuary for Deloitte. Michael is the National Public Sector Retirement Leader for Deloitte. So even though we both have national roles, we both do live and work in the state of Minnesota. So we're both taxpayers, and so we're very interested in this topic as well, personally.
Madam Chair?
No, Senator Sinjum.
Madam Chair, I just have a request, and the answer is probably so obvious. Maybe we all know it, but our guest is going to be telling us what their role is with respect to our pension commission. It sounds like a simple question, but what is our role? At the end of the day, what is our role on this commission? Does anybody have it? I think we all know it. We
right.
want a healthy system, but right. what is our role in terms of getting us there? What are the factors, and what do we have to move one way or another to make that happen?
Maybe
it just mentioned, maybe it's in the principles, and I haven't read those.
Maybe
this is for another day.
Well, I think that's a very good topic to think about as far as we could go around and each give our opinion, but we are the stewards of the pension plans, and besides the State Board of Investment, what we do around this table is very, very important for the retirement community going forward. And I think, it's probably not really eloquent, but it's sincere, and so I'll take it very serious. Senator Sinjum.
And Madam Chair, we can move on, but just at least for me, that's
why you're here.
That's why I'm here, and I would like to hear other perspectives on that as well.
Right. Well, thank you. Very thoughtful, Senator Sinjum. Appreciate that. Really brings it down to a much more, just a place where we can all relate to. So thank you. We are doing the yeoman's work. Appreciate it. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Strombeck.
Are we ready? So the contract that Deloitte has with the commission is a 5-year contract, and we're in year 3 of that contract. In the past years, the way the scope of services is laid out, we do a full replication of one plan's actuarial valuation each year. So the first year of our contract, we did a full replication of the MSRS general plan, which means we get the same data that the fund actuary used. We crunch all the same numbers to see if we can get to the same answer that they did. And for the most part, we are able to very closely match the fund actuaries. So we did that for MSRS general plan first year. Second year, we did it for PARA. This year, it's the Teacher Retirement Association's turn. So we are currently working on that replication right now. Another one of our roles is to look at every 5 or 6 years. It was 6 last time, but generally it'll be 5 years. The plans do an experience study, and that's very important because you want to make sure that the actuarial assumptions that the funds are using are the best estimate of future experience. And that was recently done for experience through calendar year 14, and so we reviewed that information in 2015. And we also looked at the standards for actuarial work, and we also prepared an experience study of the combined service annuity provision of the plan, plans, which is a provision in each of the plans where if you work in more than one system, that you can get credit. Your service credit is counted, for both places. So you don't get double credit, but you can count the service that you worked at one place at the next place if they're both in the public systems. We have also reviewed some factors, and the most important thing I think for this evening is we also looked at the investment return assumption recommendations that you've already heard from SBI about, and the recommendation to go from 8 to 7.5. So Michael will have some information for you, and I think you already did receive our letter. Susan, is that true? With our thoughts and recommendations on that topic. So you'll hear from Michael in a few minutes about that. So I think the bottom line on this slide is we view our role as a consultant to all of you, and what we would want to be able to do is to help to interpret all of the information that you're receiving from all of the various plans. And so it doesn't always seem like it fits together. And so we want to help you, interpret and, line things up so that it does make sense across each of the systems. So that's what we're going to attempt to do in the next few minutes as well. So now I'm really going to start at the beginning, the actuarial valuation process. The plans that require actuarial valuations are defined benefit plans. And there is a fundamental difference between a defined benefit plan and a defined contribution plan. And that fundamental difference is what the promise to the employees is. With the plans that you are responsible for, the promise is a fixed benefit that will be paid to participants for their lifetime. What you don't know is how much that ultimately is going to cost, because that depends on the investment reward, the risk, and that is something you don't know in advance. So we will see the numbers go up and down. With a defined contribution plan, which in the private sector, 401k is the most common, or profit sharing, that kind of an arrangement, the contribution is known going in, but what is not known is what the account balance will grow to over time. And so the fundamental difference is who takes the investment risk. And for the plans that you're talking about here today, the employer, the state, t- takes that investment risk. Now, because you have this risk, there is an actuarial valuation done each year. You measure the assets, you measure the liabilities, and you look at what your funding progress is. So the purpose of the actuarial valuation is to estimate the long-term cost of the plan and calculate appropriate contributions, annual contributions, to fund that plan. This is another very basic slide, but it is an important concept in the whole world of pensions. And that is, really, if you boil it down, there aren't that many levers to pull with a pension plan arrangement. The assets, the dollars coming in are employee and employer contributions and investment returns. Those at the end, over a life of a plan, those dollars must equal the benefits you pay out plus expenses. And so if you have a plan that's not in balance, if your projected contributions and investment return are not projected to be sufficient to cover the benefit payments and expenses, you've got to change one of these four buckets, right? So you either reduce your benefit payments or you reduce your expenses or you increase your investment return or you increase your contributions. And one of the big balancing acts with pensions these days is the balance between the contributions and the investment returns. So if you reduce your investment return, your contributions have to go up, right? And so there's a tension there because you want to keep your contributions down, but that means that you need a higher investment return, which means you have to take more risk. And so that is one of the fundamental arguments that you hear whenever a pension plan is not 100% funded is how are we going to fix it? That's what you often hear.
Madam Chair?
Senator Sanchez.
Madam Chair, this slide answers my question.
Well, we also have a statement of what it is, actually. Well, from a legislative standpoint, we act as an unofficial subcommittee to hear pension legislation and make a recommendation to the committees of record, but also to serve as a broader function, oversight, et cetera. I liked our version better. But
okay.
Ms. Strombeck.
Thank you. Okay, so now this will take a while to get through this slide, but hopefully it will make sense at the end of the day. Now, when the actuaries do their valuations, they start with inputs. They get inputs from, and first of all, the participant data from each of the systems is provided. And the data that's required is pretty extensive. It's date of birth, it's date of hire, it's compensation, it's any piece of individual participant information that could affect how that benefit promise is being calculated and projected. So that's a complicated process in itself because these are large plans, large amounts of data being moved from the systems to the actuaries each year. The actuaries take all of this participant data, put them into their actuarial model, and they also program the plan provision. So each of these systems has a fixed benefit formula. Most of them are final average pay plans, so the benefit is described as some percentage of pay per year of service times final average pay. So the actuaries consider the benefit promise from that regard as well. And then they have a whole series of assumptions that they have to make about what's going to happen in the future. So how long are people going to live? How long are they going to work? Are they going to become disabled? How much are their salaries going to increase? So all of this estimation gets put into a model and gets projected out into the future, and the actuaries come up with this benefit stream for each person, and they take those benefit streams and discount them with the probability at each year that they're going to be paid. So the probability of payment for someone in retirement status now, a year from now, is very, very high. The probability of payment for someone 30 years from now when that person is 100 is not very high, but there is some probability. that person is still going to be alive at 100. So we take those dollars and we discount them back with all those probabilities and then also with an interest rate. And that's the important concept with the investment return. Because in the public sector, these benefit streams then get discounted back at the investment return. So the present value of the benefit is what you think if you had it in the bank, if you had that much in the bank today and you earned currently, the assumption is 8% on it for the rest of that person's life, you would have enough money to cover that person's benefit. Okay? So that is done for every single person and added up. And you get to this present value of projected benefits. Now, the present value of projected benefits then has to get allocated between how much has been earned already based on service earned or worked, and how much will be earned in the future based on future service. And there are a number of different actuarial methods that you can use to do that. But the basic concept here is if a person is retired already or terminated employment already, their present value of projected benefits should equal their accrued liability. That is, you should have fully funded that person's benefit, right? Because they don't work for you anymore. And so the concept is that you should be funding things as people are working. So when we have the actuarial accrued liability, that's the red part of the equation over here, that present value gets allocated based on service already earned. And then you look at how much of that is already funded. So you look at your asset value. Okay, if your accrued liability is higher than your assets, then you have an unfunded liability, which then needs to get amortized over some future period. And that's one of the provisions in statute that you are responsible for. Right now, each of the plans uses a different amortization period. And I will show you a very scary slide in a few minutes about what that amortization period looks like. So that's the accrued piece. Then the benefits that are going to be earned in the future get allocated into the future by something called a normal cost. What we call a normal cost is of those future benefits, how much should get paid this year? How much is that benefit worth, that 1 year of service that the person is going to work? How much is that worth today? What's the contribution requirement for that? So that's the normal cost piece. So at the end of the day, the contribution is not that complicated in that there's a normal cost piece, which is that's how much people are going to earn in the coming year. And then if you have an unfunded liability, it's what piece of that unfunded liability are you going to also have to pay off in this year?
Ms. Strombeck.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there, these are all subjective things, is there a more likelihood of being able to project it properly in the red box where you actually have the person retired compared to the yellow box where you don't know how long they're going to work and how much they have to make?
Yes. Yes.
Strombeck.
I'm sorry, Senator Rosen, Representative Vogel. Yes, that is true. The retired liability is, in general, there's less risk that you're going to be wrong by much, you know, from year to year. But there's a lot of your active employees that are in the red box as well. Because, you know, if someone has worked 15 years and will work another 15, you have 15 years worth of that person's benefit in the red box. And then year 16 will be in the yellow, right? And each year it goes up, you know, one until you get to retirement. So that's a very simplified version. But I thought it was important to just try to get, you know, that picture in your mind of, you know, the annual cost plus the amortization. Now, the actuarial assumptions that are used are really extensive and complicated. I've only listed here the more important ones, but there are many others besides these. Obviously, the most important one is that investment return assumption at 8% right now is what you're using. Now, the teacher's retirement system is still using 8% through fiscal 17, and then it goes up to 8.5%. But the board did actually recommend going to 8% last year They are not currently there because the omnibus pension bill did not get passed last session. And so the TRA did actually do their calculations under the current statute, but also did parallel calculations as if the 8% had been implemented. So we do have both sets of numbers available. Now, another important assumption is the COLA increase. One of the important provisions of the state pension system is that there is a cost of living increase offered for each of the plans. They are not the same across the board necessarily, and I'll show you what they are currently. There's a very complicated provision right now in these plans that they get one COLA, but there's also a trigger that if the plans get into a higher funded status, that the COLA can increase. And that is past 101 stuff today, so I'm not going to go into much detail there, but just know that there are COLAs built into each of these, into the plan provisions, and that is one of the areas that the plans likely will be recommending some changes to plan provisions. The underlying inflation on all of these plans, the large plans, is 2.275. Now, you heard Mr. Perry say earlier that his more short-term inflation assumption is 2.25, but the plans are now, this is a longer-term assumption, the 2.75, but they have a 2.75 inflation assumption built into their assumptions that they're currently using. And St. Paul Teachers actually is a little higher than that, even at 3. Then they also have a payroll growth assumption. They have salary increase assumptions that vary by system. And then there are a series of demographic assumptions as well. How long are people going to live? When are they going to retire? There's probabilities of retirement built into these models. And when are they going to quit? And are they going to become disabled? All of those assumptions are updated every 5 years based on the actual experience of the funds. As I said, the larger ones did recently do that experience study. St. Paul Teachers is probably due for one in a year or two. Their last one was through 2011. So they are the only, St. Paul Teachers is currently the only system that has not updated their mortality assumption to this RP 2014, some version of RP 2014. For those of you who were on the commission in prior years, you will recall that was a pretty big deal when that mortality assumption was updated because people were projected to live a couple more years than previously had been assumed. And that really increases liabilities because that means you're paying pensions for a longer period of time.
Mr. Rombeck, why did not St. Paul Teachers be involved in this?
They're just on a different cycle. Oh, sorry. They're just on a different cycle in that their experience study, the last one, was done 2006 to 2011. And so they will likely, it'll be, 2012 to 2016 or 17 is probably when they'll look at it again. So I would say probably this year or next.
I wonder if it makes sense to get them on the same cycle.
It may, yes. Okay. Now, the actuarial methods that the state of Minnesota actually uses are the contribution rates that are used are actually set in the state statute. So they really don't have anything to do directly with the actuarial calculation. And so what you will see each year as the plans show their results is they'll calculate what the contribution should be based on all of these inputs and all of these assumptions and methods, and then they compare it to what the statute says the contributions actually are. And what we have seen for the last several years is the statutory contributions are not currently sufficient to cover what the actuaries are saying the contributions should be. And that's part of why we do have an unfunded liability in all of these plans for the state. Another important concept is the actuarial cost method that is used, and that is to separate that green present value of projected benefits into red, which is the accrued liability piece, and yellow, which is the future piece. You can use different methods to do that. The method that the state uses in all of their plans is what we call an entry age normal. method. And the concept here is you calculate a level percent of pay from the time that the person started work to the time the person is expected to leave work, and calculate what a level percent of payroll cost should be to fund that person's benefit. So there should be no increase built into the system. So if that number is 10% for one person, if you put in 10% every single year that they worked for you, you should have enough money when they leave. Now, that percent is different for every single person, depending on their age and how long they work and all of that. But it gets calculated individually and then added up. And that's what the normal cost percent that you will see from the actuaries represents. We note here that this method is also the required method for a GASB accounting purposes. That's not why the state uses it. The state used it before GASB required it, but it is it's good that there's some continuity there.
Mr. Rombach, just explain GASB again, please.
Oh, GASB is the Government Accounting Standards Board. So that those are the calculations that show up in the GASB in the state's financial report.
Thank you.
And then the last concept here on actuarial methods is asset smoothing. When you're investing in equities, as the SBI does, and the state pension funds are, you do see some volatility in investment returns from year to year. And so one of the common techniques so that the results don't jump around so much from year to year is this concept of asset smoothing. So there's a difference between the actuarial value of assets and the market value of assets in any year, because they take the asset gain and loss, so the difference between what they expected to earn and what the fund actually earned, and they recognize those gains and losses over a five-year period. And the concept there is that should smooth out your contribution requirements over time. Okay, here's the scary slide I had mentioned. The amortization of the unfunded liability. And this is different for each of the plans. The general concept in the statute is that the unfunded liability should be amortized over 30 years. However, when there are plan provision changes or actuarial assumption changes, that amortization period can be reset. And so what has happened over time is, I'll take the green line first. So MSRS had, way back in 1967, they had a 30-year amortization period on their unfunded liability. But there was a plan change or an assumption change or something happened in 1979. And so they decided to reset their amortization. So they started their 30-year period over again, right? And you can see that each of the plans has done that several times. And so this 30-year amortization that should have been paid for a long time ago is not paid for, because you keep resetting the amortization period. This is not uncommon, but it is part of the reason that we still do have unfunded liabilities in the state. And you'll note the other point here, I think, on this page is if you look at the end point we're at for each of the plans, one of the reasons that it's difficult to compare apples to apples for each of these plans is they all have a different amortization period. And so we have, actually, St. Paul Teachers and MSRS are coincidentally about the same, right? and they're at 26 years right now. But TRA is a little bit lower than that. And PARA is the shortest amortization period right now at 17 years.
Mr. Rombach.
Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I look at this, it's been kind of a reset and then a downtrend. I'm wondering if there was any study done as to whether or not that was caused by market forces, which might be a recession, or more so maybe accounting changes that might have made it reflect better.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rombach.
Senator Rosen, Representative Vogel, there are a number of factors that I think cause the increase in the unfunded liability or the actuarial losses that we've seen over time. Some of it was plan changes and assumption changes, but over the recent period, very few pension plans over a long period have gotten the investment returns that they were planning to get. And, you know, over a long period, they probably have, but that 2008 event really hurt a lot of pension plans, and they're still recovering. The life expectancy change also is another reason, you know, that we're looking at higher unfunded right now than otherwise you would expect. But there, you know, there are probably many other factors.
Representative Vogel.
Madam Chair, I guess the concern I have when I look at this is that it's not the spikes down, but the spikes up and what caused them. Because it seems that every time it spikes up, it goes down, but now we're going to lower lows, which would indicate to me that there's more of a problem.
Yeah.
So the question is kind of, have there been changes maybe in the plan's assumptions made over the years that might have made it look better for a little bit, but then actually reality kicked in and brought it back down?
Yeah. Senator Rose and Representative Vogel. Actually, being low on this chart is good. In that they're amortizing over the a shorter period of time to get to full funding if you're lower on the chart. So PARA's unfunded is being amortized over a 17-year period. So they're paying for their unfunded faster than the plans that are higher on the chart.
Madam Chair, yes, Representative Vogel, I just wanted to add a thought there. If you could imagine, it's sort of like if you have a home mortgage. So MSRS back in 1967 bought a home and you know, had a 30-year loan payment. They were going along fine, but in 1978 they decided to refinance their mortgage and took out a new 30-year loan to pay that back. And they kept doing that. So all these plans basically, for whatever reason, either because they had, you know, huge asset losses, or maybe the contributions became unaffordable for other economic reasons, or you know, the plans were changed, or assumptions, you know, people started living longer, and it's like, well, we can't afford this at this current rate. So whatever new information came out, they decided we need to refinance our mortgage again at 30 years and pay it down. So that's what's been happening. Every time it goes back up, basically the mortgage is being refinanced. So right now, for example, PARA hasn't refinanced their mortgage in a long time, but the other three plans have.
Okay, so now I'm going to get to some actual numbers. I know there are a lot of numbers on this page, so I'm hoping you all have this in front of you as well if it's hard to see on the screen. You will see that each of the plans, the way we have this laid out is the large plans, the MSRS General, PARA General, the Teachers Retirement Association, and then the St. Paul Teachers have their own columns, and then we've included all the other plans that are included in your purview. So the other plans that MSRS administers, that PARA administers, are in this other plan column. So if you look at MSRS just as an example, there the actuarial value of assets for that particular system as of July 1 of 16 was $11.7 billion. The actuarial accrued liability, which is the red part in that earlier chart, for this plan was $14.3 billion. So there's a $2.6 billion shortfall right now, an unfunded liability for MSRS. The funded ratio for that plan is 81.6. And if you can look across to see, you know, the results for each of the plans, but they all currently have unfunded liabilities. The middle part of this chart is showing the annual contributions that are being paid right now, or will be paid for this fiscal year. The employees have a contribution requirement. The employers have a statutory contribution requirement. And then there are, for some of the systems, there are also additional contributions that are currently built into the statute as well. So the $37 million for PARA, for example, is the city of Minneapolis is contributing $31 million annually because of that MRF merger that happened a few years ago, and the state also is paying another $6 million, and that will continue until 2031, I believe, is the last end date for that particular contribution. Both of the teacher systems also have additional statutory contributions from the state that are paid annually. And some of the other plans have those contributions as well. So that's that additional contribution line. So for all the plans, contributions coming in are about $2.4 billion a year. Now, the actuaries calculate what, based on those assumptions and the methods, what the normal cost and the amortization should be for each of the funds. And you can see, again, starting with on the left, MSRS's normal cost is $237 million. Their amortization, based on a 26-year period, I believe, is $171 million, and then $11 million of expenses. So the actuaries are saying that MSRS should be contributing $419 million, and we're only taking in $318 million. So there's a $100 million shortfall, deficiency, for just that system. So you can look across and see that, you know, they each have deficiencies, and it's the deficiency annually is $500 million for all of the systems. Now, this is assuming 8%. If you change to 7.5, these numbers are all going to go up. It's going to look worse, not better. Okay. The next page is this information again, but expressed in terms of a percentage of contributions, or percentage of payroll contribution, annual contributions. At the top, we do have, there are usually two funded ratios that are reported. One is the actuarial value, based on actuarial value of assets, which is that smoothed value, and the other is the market value. And right now, each of the funds is showed, the actuarial value is about 3% higher than the market value. That means that there are some actuarial losses that have not been completely realized yet in the actuarial calculations. So if you look at a percentage of pay, then the required contributions, again, for MSRS first, is 8.2% of payroll. The amortization rate is 5.9, and there's another 0.4% of payroll for expenses, so the total should be 14.5%. They're only taking in 11, according to the statute right now, so there's a 3.5% of payroll deficiency. And that's using a 26-year amortization. PARA is in better shape because even at just with a 17-year amortization, so their amortization is higher because they have a shorter mortgage payment the way it's working right now. They have a 1.9% deficiency as opposed to 3.5%. TRA is at 5.5%. And St. Paul Teachers has a smaller one. But again, I think one of the points here is when you are making, you're thinking about where you're going to spend the state's money and, you know, where it makes the most sense to allocate these funds, it would be nice to get this on an apples-to-apples basis, and this isn't that, because you have the amortization periods different for, you know, for each of the plans. So that would be one of our recommendations to you, is that, you know, as you're thinking through all of this, it might be helpful to couch it in those terms. The other information down at the bottom is just the multiplier, the benefit multiplier for new hires is 1.7 for the general plans, 1.9 for the teachers plans, and this is where they do have different COLAs right now. MSRS is getting 2% cost of living adjustments, as is TRA. PARA and St. Paul Teachers have a 1% COLA built in currently. This is the last slide before I take it over or hand it over to Michael for some landscape comments. But another way to think about this, even if you don't accept, you know, or if you don't, the 8% versus 7.5, and what's the right number, or should it even be a lower investment return? That's one whole argument. Another way to look at this whole situation is just on a cash flow basis. And the more cash flow is negative, the more pressure there is on investment return with a pension plan. And you can see here the contributions that are being made to each of these programs or each of these systems right now are not covering the benefits and expenses that are leaving the system. So you are in a negative cash flow position. the investment returns in a good year will make up for that. But in the year we just had, for example, that did not happen. And so the net investment returns were actually slightly negative when you expected to get almost $1 billion for the MSRS and $1.5 billion for PARA. So that was not a good year, you know, from an investment return assumption perspective. Now, that will balance out over time, and you will have years where it is good. But that's just another, you know, way to think about it is from a cash flow perspective what's happening. So with that, I'll turn it over to Michael, and he has some benchmarking information, I think is what we're going to start
with. Thank you, Ms. Strombeck. You bet. Mr. DeLeon. Are there any questions for Ms. Strombeck before we go on? Okay. Thank you, Mr. DeLeon.
All right, Madam Chair. So before I get started in my public sector background, I guess I want to give a little personal opinion here. I spend my career focused on public sector retirement plans, and I do that because I enjoy it, and I'm passionate about it. And public sector is one of the last bastions for ongoing defined benefit pension plans. And I think they are really valuable because ultimately they're the most efficient way to spend a dollar to provide employees with retirement benefits. So they're more efficient than any other, than a defined contribution plan. However, there are a lot of challenges with a defined benefit plan, as you know, you had to learn a lot of information about how to understand a pension plan. And then we have the discount rate, which I'll talk about more, which, you know, if we didn't have that problem of knowing what our rates of return would be, pension plans would be very easy to understand and very easy to utilize. But the benefit of a pension plan is that, especially in the public sector, where it's an ongoing entity that presumably will never go away, you can take risks. You know, you can protect the individual from the risks of their mortality, their longevity. You know, you have a large pool, so some people will die young, some people will die old. They don't each have to be responsible for how long they're going to live and protect just against their longevity. You can do that as a group. Same with investment risk. You know, an individual who's 80 years old can't be invested in the stock market because if they have a huge drop, you know, they can't afford to live the next 5 years. But the pension plan can handle that because if they take a huge loss, yes, you'll end up having to probably put in more contributions, but presumably you'll have a huge gain some other year. And the fact that you have, you know, 20-year-olds paying into the plan and 90-year-olds taking money out and everybody in between, you know, you can protect them. So that's really the benefit of a pension plan is the ability to manage risks in because you have these large groups and you have an ongoing entity of the state. Now, that stepping back from that, I'll now talk about some of the problems with pension plans that have come up, especially over the last 20 years and some of the challenges that everyone across the country is facing. So this you don't have a unique problem here because everyone's struggling with pensions, and I'm sure you've read many pension articles across the country about some of the challenges. I would say in general, Minnesota's above average in their management of pension plans, but that doesn't mean there's not room for improvement because there certainly is, and it's not, you know, the plans still have a ways to go to get to 100% funded. So on this slide, we have some background of what the average plans are doing across the country as far as first the funded ratio, so how the assets compare to the liabilities. The bar graphs, you can just sort of see that the assets and liabilities have been steadily growing from $2 trillion to $4 trillion, so they've doubled over the last 14 years. And over that same time, obviously, assets have not doubled. They've gone from $2 trillion to $3 trillion. So that means that the plans are not as well funded as they were. This is similar to your plans. In the state of Minnesota in 2001, MSRS and TRA were both over 100% funded. PARA was a little under. I believe they were closer to 90%. So you had plans that were over 100% funded. Then the stock market crashed once. The stock market crashed again. You know, while some efforts were made to try to change the plan, you know, our equation of investments and contributions going in and benefit payments and expenses coming out, you made some changes along there. You increased some of the contributions coming in. You reduced some of the benefits coming out, affected things like the cost of living adjustment and other benefit provisions. But ultimately, you know, the plans right now are between 72 and 82% funded. Those assets coming out, those investment returns, were the biggest driver of that change.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. DeLeon, correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't there also incidences when we were more funded closer to the 100% range, where then there's a lot of pressure to increase benefits and reduce employers' contribution. And isn't that part of the story of kind of what got us into trouble in addition to the stock market?
Mr. DeLeon.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, that's a good point, and one that I failed to mention of when I was touting all the good things about pension plans. I failed to mention one of the challenges, which is political risk. And it happened across the country, again, that, you know, when you reach the point where you're 100% funded, or let's say 120% funded, you start to say, well, we have all this extra money. We shouldn't keep it. Let's give it to the employees, to the retirees. And so you start changing benefits to improve them. Well, the markets are cyclical. So even though, you know, we think over a really long time you can earn 7.5%, 8%, there are going to be years in which you go negative. There's going to be years like in the 90s when you are extremely positive for a long period of time. And when you get that well overfunded, there is this risk that that politics can take over and make the decision to improve benefits at the cost of the plan without sort of instead saving for a rainy day. So, yes, some of those decisions that were made back in the 90s of how to spend those excess dollars did lead to part of this situation.
And, Madam Chair, just another reminder, I think particularly with the St. Paul Teachers Plan, the legislature relieved the St. Paul School District from paying into the plan for a number of years because it was well-funded. And that's why we pay on a, whatever you call, additional contribution the St. Paul School District does to make up for those years where they didn't pay into the plan. But, of course, if you don't pay into the plan in the early years, it just compounds the problem as time goes along. So that's why I'm not a big proponent of 100% funding. I think if we're at 90, 95%, and not quite reaching that, then you're less at risk for the pressure of trying to either reduce what the employers are paying in, say the state's having a tough year, and so we were going to cut some of the payments to MSRS, or we don't have quite enough money to give the school districts, so we'll cut some of the payments from the school districts, and then it really can wreak havoc on our pension funds.
Mr. DeLeon.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, thank you. That is another very good point, because that is another problem that happened across the country. Funding holidays happen in a lot of places. There's a number of states that I'm thinking of California specifically, that had 10, 20-year funding holidays where they contributed nothing to their plans because they'd gotten so well-funded. And then when you start asking people to pay in again, it's not only, hard to get that going, but it ramps up so fast. It's like, well, I was only paying $10 million 5 years ago. Now you're asking me to pay $200 million. It's like, well, you should have been paying $100 million every year, but because you didn't, now we have to make up for that quicker. So that is a very good point and one of the challenges that happened as a result of those high-funded rates. Okay, so on the next slide, I have a comparison of contribution rates. And this is, again, median contribution rates across the country, comparing employers with Social Security versus those without Social Security, because there's the separate amount that employers and employees pay in if they're members of Social Security. And a couple of things I think to draw from. Across the country, contribution rates have been steadily increasing. That's not too surprising. Employees have started to bear more of that responsibility. The median, is sort of slowly moving. But there's certainly a lot of plan changes across the country where they've asked employees to put in more. There is a fundamental question of what you want to do, what your expectation is of your employees. Should they share equal amounts in the risks? Should they share a third of the risk and you share two-thirds? How do you want to balance that? You can see that on the national average, you have at least back in 2002, when things were going really well, the split was a little closer to 50-50 on average. Now it's become to the point where the employer is paying about twice as much as the employee, so about two-thirds, one-third. Right now for your plans, it's a little bit mixed, but it's closer to the 50-50 split between employees and employers that you expect to pay. All right, this next graph is a doozy. And I'm going to try to explain it to you because it does have some important points to make. Really, this is, from left to right, it's telling what's happening over time. So going back to 2001 to the present, what have the discount rates, what are the rate of returns assumed by pension plans across the country, how have they moved? So what you'll see here, if we start at the far left, up in the top you had a few plans that were using interest rates of greater than 8.5. You had another chunk that were using 8.5, another, that white group, using between 8 and 8.5. Then the largest group in the blue were using 8% as their assumed rate of return. Again, these are long-term assumptions. We expect this is what you might earn over a 30, 40-year period. And then there were a few that were under 8% back then. Now, what you see as you move from left to right is a lot fewer are in the top of that graph that are using over 8, a lot fewer are using 8, and much more are using the 7.5 to 8 or even the 7 to 7.5. And now we start to see this red group pop up in the bottom right-hand corner of people using even less than 7% as their assumed rate of return. Now, as actuaries, again, if we could just know what that discount, what that rate of return is going to be on investments, this would be a very easy discussion. So this is the big problem, is that we can't accurately guess what's going to happen in the future. And I think there's just been a general shift across the country of people recognizing these rates of return that we are basing our, you know, our mindset is around the 90s. And, yeah, we had some horrible times. I mean, you know, back in 2001, it's like you're coming out of the 90s and you're just thinking, things can't go wrong, right? I mean, we should all move out of DBs and go to DC plans because we can be earning 20, 30% out here. Why am I only getting this 8%? Why is the plan only giving me a guaranteed 8% of return? The employee might be thinking to themselves, I'd rather be like my neighbor who's working for a private sector company and getting, you know, unbelievable 40% returns on 30% returns on their investments in their 401k plans. Fast forward 14 years later, and we have the opposite. The pendulum swung a long way the other way. We had two stock market crashes. The neighbor now has, you know, can't retire because they don't have enough money in their defined contribution plans. And pension plans are thinking, you know, maybe the good times aren't coming back again. Let's move the other direction. Now, you know, in 30 and 40 year time frames, we like to keep the discount rate the same as long as we can, but you have to recognize that maybe we are in a new reality. Maybe there is a new paradigm. Maybe we'll never see the 90s again. One thing about moving your discount rate down and why so many plans are doing it is because it reduces the risk that you will run out of money. That's ultimately what it does. It also, that's the good thing about it is that it will reduce the risk of having much higher contributions later on, or having, or running out of money. So ultimately, the more money you can put in up front, the better, the more secure your benefits are going to be ultimately. So that's why a lower discount rate is useful from that point of view. Obviously, the negatives are you have more money you have to put in, so you have to come up with that money. And secondly, you run the risk of intergenerational transfer. So what happens is you might be paying too much money today and not as much on the lesser money later on. So you would be paying too much today and not putting enough on the future costs. Realistically, that's not often been a problem, as Senator Pappas pointed out. You know, people tended to take contribution holidays or increase benefits. So in other words, they were kicking the can down the road and shifting costs the other way. They were making the other mistake and basically overguessing and, you know, basically pushing the problems on our younger generations to pay for these benefits. So in general, a more conservative discount rate is going to be preferable if you can afford it, is ultimately what it comes down to. I just wanted to make a quick note that CalPERS, which is the largest pension plan in the country, largest public sector pension plan in the country, on December 20th reduced their discount rate, their long-term rate of return assumption, from 7.5 to 7. And the California Teachers is considering the same thing at their next board meeting, of going from 7.5 down to 7.25 or 7. So just it's one point, and obviously they could be invested differently. There's a lot of other factors, but just wanted to make that one note.
Mr. DeLeon, if we could start wrapping it up, because I think everybody is
certainly, Madam Chair,
to their end.
So then I'll not spend too much time on this page, because you do have our report, our letter that we wrote on this. But basically, all the plans are considering moving from 8 down to 7.5%, except for the teachers, which are wanting to look at 7.5% for a short period of time, and then going to 8 after 5 years. In general, we recommend that we believe that 7.5 is a reasonable assumption and would be appropriate to move down to that. We do not recommend using a different discount rate for one of the plans than the other two plans, especially going from 7.5 to 8. They're all invested in the exact same way. They're all invested by SBI in the same manner. So having a different discount rate doesn't make sense on a global sense. You know, they're all going to earn the same rate of return in general. So having a separate rate of return may not be appropriate. And it certainly confuses things when you're trying to make decisions about how each one of these is funded if one is using a different discount rate than the others. So I guess that's the takeaway from that page. The remainder of this deck, I'll just make one more comment on this, on the funding policies. You know, you have to make a decision. There's been a lot of studies recently coming out of the time when people weren't making contributions, or people were, you know, the accounting standards have kind of moved away from talking about how long you should amortize liabilities and anything like that, that there's been this vacuum of, well, how should we fund a pension plan? What's the best way to do it? And there have been a lot of public sector funding policy discussions that have taken place by some, you know, some actuarial groups, finance officer groups, different ones that have looked at this. And I won't get into it, but there's, you know, we can definitely come back to you and give you some more of our thoughts on what's an appropriate way to fund a pension plan, you know, what some of the best practices are that are out there right now. Lastly, I'll just mention that there is a whole other set of numbers out there that is, we talked about government accounting standard boards. I don't want to confuse you with these numbers, but I will just mention that, you know, if you hear talk about another set of numbers, realize it is for accounting purposes, not for contribution for funding purposes. And, you know, we can certainly come back and talk more about why they're different and what they mean. But just understand that you might hear a different set of numbers that don't match up with what you've been seeing. It's probably because those are the accounting numbers. I think that concludes. I did have some comments on bond rating agencies, but I'll skip that for this time and answer any questions if they're happy.
Any questions, members? Representative Murphy, you have that look. Thank you. Representative Murphy, does anybody have any comments on the presentation? No? Okay. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy, you could give that presentation. I know you could. Well, any other questions? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not on the presentation, but it was excellent, and I can't even say it was a good review. It was just good. Madam Chair, I'm glad you brought up the principles, and I just want to maybe put on our to-do list for during the interim to spend some time going over the principles. Because I don't think we've done that for a few years. I don't believe we did it when I was chair or when Representative O'Driscoll was chair. So didn't we? We did it when Representative Murphy was chair.
Representative Murphy, how long ago was that? You don't remember. Who's going to remember in this room? Thank you, Senator Pappas. That's a very, very good rule. Thank you very much, Ms. Strombeck and Mr. DeLeon, for coming. I really appreciate your time on this. I would appreciate you coming back and having a look at some of the reforms that we're going to look at ongoing, and we need your advice and expertise and keep us on the path going forward. So look forward to working with you and doing some good work with you all. Any further comments? With that, the Pension Commission is adjourned. See you next week, members.